Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. It's June 10th, 2012. We're almost halfway through this mysterious and auspicious year. Sunspots are no longer sunspots, Earth Explorers. They are now sunspot clusters. Unbelievably active. Like a triple-barreled shotgun aimed at the Earth almost every day now. Many people have said, well, we've been crying wolf for a long time. Well, no, we haven't really, because the solar maximum doesn't even occur for about 6 months, but we are building up to it in a very spectacular way. NASA knows it, JPL knows it, and all the listeners to this program know it. Because we want you to be aware. We want you to keep your footing and not be taken by surprise. Solar wind has been all over the place this week, from about 300 to almost 600 kilometers per second. It's almost straight-up winter time. Another 11 days, it'll be straight-up winter time in the southern hemisphere. And still, we are seeing auroras in the northern hemisphere. Very strange for this time of year. We want you to be part of the program, so as you're joining us, I'll make the announcement several times tonight. Our toll-free number, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. And you can also be part of the program by listening via a conference line, which we have set up for you. You simply call 760-569-7676, and then the passcode 192919. Pound, 192919 pound. That will allow you to listen to the program without necessarily participating in the program. Kind of a nice setup, if you know what I mean. You can walk around with a wry smile on your face while you're being entertained. And tonight we're going to have a tribute to science fiction. I would say my mentor, but I never met him. I just read almost everything he wrote and was so influenced by his style, the titling of his work and the subject matter of his work, Mr. Ray Bradbury. You know, authored The Martian Chronicles and Fahrenheit 451. Those are ones that were made into TV series or film. And others which influence science fiction writers and movie writers for decades and decades, who passed away this week at 91. I'm going to bring up Isaac Asimov, passed away several years ago, but a fellow chemist. I know all chemists are poets, and poetry is a compressed language, a metaphoric way of looking at the whatever language it happens to be written in. And Isaac Asimov wrote some amazing short stories as well, and we're going to read one tonight. I'm sure it's one you've never heard before. It was in literature books, 30 years ago, as an example of science fiction, and many, many examples have come and gone since then. But this one is something that I'm sure will entertain you tonight. Couple of years ago, we read one called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin. We got some good mail off of that one. Very interesting how the elite of any society, and this was epitomized in this classic science fiction treatise on human society, how we will almost hold hostage or sacrifice the very most innocent of our societies for the opulence of the most elite. And, you know, I've been in manufacturing my whole life, so naturally I've worked in some very large facilities and some medium-sized facilities. And I've seen it repeated many times where, you know, line workers or technicians, team members from the line have been promoted to be supervisors or in some form or fashion been responsible for direct reports. And I've seen how just the mere position changes people. Not everyone, but certain individuals over time tend to have dominion over other individuals, as they would suppose. What humans, I think, need to learn, and I think are learning generation by generation, and thus we are evolving, is that dominion is only a perception of the person who thinks he has it. It is actually a gift given by those over whom he lords. And if it is not given, no amount of force will make it so. One of the other things we covered on this program last year was the X-37B mission. Now, this is a surprising little craft. It's about a quarter the size of the standard space shuttle. Good grapefruit juice. And it's unmanned. It's a robotic craft. It was launched early last year. And then we issued you a report that the little beggar had changed orbits because Heavens Above was tracking it, and then it lost it, and then it found it again. It turns out that it was able to boost itself to a higher orbit for a while. Maybe that was part of its mission. Some people suspected that it was up there to spy on the Chinese Chang'e, which means Heavenly Palace space station that the Chinese launched. Not very likely, since the two passed each other at about 17,000 miles an hour. They were on skewed orbits, so it doesn't make much sense that we would be monitoring that craft. The other thing is that in early or late winter last year, the X-37B landed. And now we have an announcement that the secret mission has been accomplished. America's mysterious space plane to land after a year in orbit, and no one knows what it did up there. It's been circling the Earth at 17,000 miles an hour and was due to land in California in December. But we had a record of it landing in December. We had pictures of it landing in December. Now, the mission is of highly classified nature. And now it's going to land in late to mid-June. So the question I have, and I think everyone should be asking, is, did we have two X-37Bs in orbit? If you remember the history of this strange little plane, it was a project that was put together by NASA through JPL. And like most government projects, it ran over budget. And it eventually had to petition for more money, and it was not approved. However, the petition drew some interesting attention, namely from the United States Air Force. And so the Air Force moved in and said, I'll tell you what, we'll move in, we'll take over this project, we're going to put it on our expedited project list. We're going to put it on a fast track. And when they did that, it was put on what we typically call a black budget. That is to say, there was no accounting. No one knows how much money the Air Force spent on the X-37B project. But the next thing you know, it was done. And when it was done and the cargo bay doors were closed on something inside that craft, nobody knows what's in it. This highly secret unmanned space plane, the Boeing X-37B, has been circling Earth with, we don't know what in it. It was accompanied, at launch, the space plane was accompanied by a staff in biohazard suits, leading to speculation that there were radioactive components on board. Now, you know what a biohazard suit is. There are three classes. There's an A, there's a B, and there's a C. An A class is basically a paper coveralls with rubber gloves and a respirator and safety glasses. That's a class A. A class B, you have a little bit more protection, a better suit, better gloves, tape around the cuffs and around the boots, maybe a forced air respirator. And a classic biohazard suit is a class C. And a class C, you typically have an SCBA. That's a self-contained breathing apparatus. You actually wear compressed air tanks on your back. Then the suit goes over the tanks, so you really look big and bulky, and you are. And you really have to be in good shape to be able to wear one of these suits. You have you're completely sealed in. Now, there are two reasons why you would wear such a suit. One is that there's some kind of gas in the area, say a solvent or some other kind of heavy gas that would float around ground level and you don't want to respirate it. So you wear a full face mask, SCBA, with this external vinyl suit on with ripstop material in it, and you wear, you know, special gloves and special covers. Actually, your shoes go inside the suit. The other is if you're dealing with plutonium. Now, plutonium is not a gamma emitter. It's an alpha emitter, which means it's a beta particle. A beta particle is a relatively large compared to an X-ray or a gamma ray proton. And it's, although very small, it can be ingested. And it's very poisonous. A little bit of plutonium would kill a whole room full of people. So you wear one of these suits to protect yourself from that. So they're wearing biohazard suits at the launch of this craft. So if you ever get a chance to look at the photos, you'll see these have metal cuffs around the legs and around the arms, and you're wearing a breathing apparatus, and you have an SCBA shield, a sealed mask over your face, and then you have the suit with a clear visor or faceplate over the top of that. So you're really quite safe. And this craft is about 10 or 11 feet high and about 40 feet long. So it's, like I said, about a quarter the size of the space shuttle. And it was put together in Vandenberg, which is in California. And it looks like a mini space shuttle. And it was meant to land in March, as I said, but the mission of the X-37B orbital test vehicle was extended for unknown reasons, and nobody's talking. In its glider form, it's 29 feet long, and it has a solar panel that can be deployed on an arm so that it can power itself for really indefinitely. But it was up for the original mission was 270 days, and now it's gone well over 365 days. The Air Force said the second mission was to further test the technology, but the ultimate purpose has largely remained a complete mystery. The Vehicle Systems Program Director, Lieutenant Colonel Tom McIntyre, told the Los Angeles Times way back in December, "We initially planned for a 9-month mission. Keeping the X-37B in orbit will provide us with additional experimentation opportunities and allow us to extract the maximum value out of the mission." So it is now on its way back to ground. Many skeptics think that the vehicle's mission is defense or spy-related. As I said, to spy on maybe the Chinese space station, not likely. They would only have maybe 1 or 2 seconds every day to take a look at it. But there's a lot that this little vehicle can do that we can't do with a manned vehicle. Last May, amateur astronomers were able to detect the orbital pattern of the first X-37B, which included flyovers of North Korea, Iraq, Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan. Other industry analysts have speculated that the Air Force is just making use of the X-37B's amazing fuel efficiency and keeping it in space for as long as possible to show off its credentials and protect it from budget cuts, which also could be true. So it's an interesting project, but we're pretty sure now that it's a weapon system. After all, under budget cuts for 2013 to 2017 proposed by the Obama administration, the office that developed the X-37B will actually be shut down. According to the X-37B manufacturer Boeing, the space plane operates in low Earth orbit between 110 and 500 miles above Earth. By comparison, the International Space Station orbits at about 220 miles. So it's just kind of interesting to see what's going on. The folks at Wars R Us, what they're keeping in space, who are they watching? Again, if you want to be part of the program tonight, it's 888-429-5471. There's so much happening in the news, and I know many of you have read things and heard things that I haven't heard. We're going to try to cover most of it tonight. We're going to cover the Bilderbergs meeting and what that could possibly mean, how that relates to human activities on the Earth and what we can do about it, what we have done about it, and we're going to talk about their level of frustration. We have a good handle on it. We're also going to discuss it's the second time, actually, because we were on Freedom Link Radio last night with Chris Geo, and we discussed this plan, which is what I call Control-Alt-Delete. I think you're going to like it. It might be something you want to talk to your congressman about. I did, and it was received very well. And, of course, yeah, I'm not trying to do any self-aggrandizement or anything, but since I had my motorcycle accident, I have nothing better to do than sit around the house and think all the time, and that can be dangerous, as you know. So developing this plan called Control-Alt-Delete was, I think, a stroke of possibly trying to get the Republic back into our hands. I think it would be a good idea. Also in the news, the secret to long life has been discovered. I know you're waiting to hear what it is. The good news is it's not broccoli. Living to very old age may be in the genes, as the saying goes, and a recent study published in the journal Aging suggests that certain personality traits make up a major part of the mix of longevity genes. Now, my good friend Bruce Lipton, who's been on this program a couple of times, we've talked about his book, The Biology of Belief. And as you know, in Bruce's amazing interview here on this program, we went well beyond what he actually put into that book. And we discovered mutually here on this program that not only does human consciousness become integrally involved in the genetic process of making proteins for the human body. Many of you who listen to this program already know what that means, but as it turns out, when scientists finally counted the number of gene pairs that make up the human body, they came up woefully short for the number of genes it takes to make the number of proteins they know make up the human body, which inconclusively proved to them, irrefutably proved to them that genes make multiple proteins. Proteins don't make themselves. They're actually made by the genes of the human body. The process of unfolding and recollapsing proteins is a genetic process. So the genes have a catalog of proteins that they can make. And so the question naturally is asked, what are the
influences on the genes that make the proteins that make up the human body. And Bruce proved in his book and in his extensive research that it is the human consciousness and the level of that human consciousness that is that influence. It's also how much sun you're exposed to, how much water you drink, what kind of stress levels you're under, what your diet is made of, those kinds of things, those kinds of environmental influences. But not only him, but Dr. John Turner out of Hawaii and others who we've interviewed on this program have supported the idea that I'm going to call it the attitude, the vibrational level of the being inside the biological transducer has a lot to do with how the genes operate in the human body. So many identical twins have been studied, literally thousands of pairs of identical twins whose genetics, sampled at a very young age, say 1 year old, are almost identical. But later in life, say at age 40 or 50, the genetics are quite different. Well, how can that be? They're genetically identical. Well, yes, they are at birth. But the being inside the body continuously influences how those genes produce proteins. And when that genetic material is sampled later in life, the genes have changed according to the influence of the consciousness inside the body. Now, researchers have found that having a positive attitude and a sense of humor could play a role in living a longer, healthier life. I mean, how many people do you know that just have a sour attitude and they're sick all the time? And then you know people that always look on the bright side of things, always seem to get up after they fall down, never complain or rarely complain, and always dream of better days and work hard for it. They seem to live longer. And that the population of both types of people is pretty conclusive. They developed a questionnaire designed to identify certain genetically based traits, personality traits, and used it to assess 243 Ashkenazi Jewish adults between 95 and 107 years of age. That's a pretty good sampling. The investigators chose this population because their genetic similarity would make it easier to account for genetic differences in personality. Because, as you know, that age group of that race, the Ashkenazi Jews, don't marry outside their race. They don't marry outside their tribe. And so the genetics tend to be pretty pure. The markers don't get scattered. The results indicated they had two things: a positive attitude for life, meaning they are optimistic, easygoing, extroverted, laughed more, and expressed emotions rather than bottling them up, said Dr. Nil Barzilai, a study co-author and director of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine's Institute for Aging Research. The study participants also were less neurotic and more conscientious than a representative sample of other Americans. Based on census data, centenarians, those people that live longer than 100, make up about 0.2% of the U.S. population, but the number has been rapidly increasing, the authors wrote. I have an audio clip. I'm going to go ahead and play that now so you can hear a part of the study. I think it's pretty interesting.
A new number tonight here, Americans living to 90 or older tripling in the last two decades, but it turns out we're still way behind turtles, fish, even worms. It's one of the many big discoveries unveiled at the renowned Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference, better known as TED. Tonight we join forces. Every month, Ted and Diane will bring you amazing thinkers changing how we see the world. Tonight, changing the way we define a long life. Here's ABC's Jay Shadler.
What a drag it is getting old.
No doubt the Rolling Stones weren't thinking about roundworms when they lamented the perils of longevity. But for this little critter, getting old really is a drag, and it happens fast. elderly and wrinkled at 10 days, dead at 2 weeks. But at her lab at the University of California, Dr. Cynthia Kenyon has found the little roundworm may hold the key to an ancient quest.
If you look in nature, you see that different kinds of animals can have really different lifespans.
A koi fish, for instance, can live to be 250 years old. And a lot of turtles, God bless them, are still teenagers at 80.
So that suggests that somewhere in these genes, somewhere in the DNA, are genes for aging.
In fact, Dr. Kenyon's pinpointed a combination of rare genes that seem to counter the effects of aging. Significantly, those unusual humans who live to 100 and beyond are more likely than the rest of us to carry these genes.
Under normal circumstances, the old Grim Reaper inside each of us is a sort of speed demon, obsessed with the finish line, death. But Dr. Kenyon's research suggests he can be slowed down, way down, to a crawl, which brings us back to the roundworm.
So what you're seeing here is a normal worm.
By masking just one gene, called DAF2, Dr. Kenyon's team have kept the little squirmers squirming way past their normal lifespan. In human years, this roundworm is about 90, but looks and acts like a 30-year-old.
But he's not in the nursing home. He's running the nursing home.
But do we really want to live so long? Yes, says Kenyon, if we can live well, and believes youth-boosting drugs based on work from this lab could be less than 15 years away. And just in case you're wondering, the lab's oldest roundworms are still wriggling at 84 days. In human years,
that's like 480 years old. My mortgage would be paid.
What about your retirement accounts would be really big?
Jay Shadler, ABC News, San Francisco.
Good piece by ABC News. So, what do you think? 888-429-5471 of living to 480 years old. What do you think? What would you do with all that time? For one thing, I think most of us would probably slow down a little bit. You know, when we talk about the Nephilim, and we're going to have L.A. Marzulli on this program here in a couple of weeks, and we're going to talk about his new film, Watchers 4, coming out. The Anunnaki, the Watchers, the Nephilim, are, by our standards, timeless. They can live tens of thousands of years. We have a tendency to, at least in the West, look at getting things done in a single lifetime as kind of slow. We would like to get them done in a summer if we could. We like to build the businesses in a matter of years so that we can live on the wealth within a reasonable amount of time so that we're not on oxygen wheeling a chair around as a wealthy person. We're still able to play tennis and actually get a suntan without worrying about skin cancer. We would like to accomplish these things in a reasonable amount of time. We'd like to see the ability to maybe not have to work full-time for a living at age 60 because, you know, 60 is the new 40. 40 is the new 20. 20 is the new, well, I don't know what 20 is the new. But you notice that people out there don't age the way that they used to. Now, some people do. Some people are just, well, they're just flat old. But you look at other people, you know, like myself, well beyond 50, you know, I can still play tennis with 30-year-olds. But that's just, you know, maybe it's my genetics. Maybe it's just my wonderful positive attitude. Maybe I've decided consciously to take control of my genetic manufacturing. Even the doctors are amazed that after my motorcycle accident, I'm healing as well as I am. And that's just... I think common, much more common than we think. But what do you think about that, living to be 480 years old? I think, you know, we all have our own ideas, but like the newscaster was saying on ABC News, hey, my mortgage would finally be paid. You know, most people, well, in the Midwest anyway, or maybe in the South, they never see their houses paid off. They have a house payment their entire life, because they keep moving up to larger and larger houses. Now, in the West, maybe not so. I know in Utah, when I lived out there, one street that I lived on, everybody on the street owned their homes. Nobody had a mortgage. But that was just the culture. in Utah. You doubled and tripled up on your payments. You used your tax refund checks. You worked a second job in the summertime, and you paid your house off in 10 or 15 years. That's just what people did. Elsewhere where I've lived, it's just one of the facts of life that you're going to be making a house payment your entire life. Many people have reached the point where they have freed themselves from the trappings of a mortgage and having to have things in order to feel fulfilled in this life. And so they're able to survive on much less, and thus they have a much lower stress level. But previous research has suggested that the oldest adults may be already genetically predisposed to living longer and healthier, both physiologically and psychologically, and that personality can affect a person's physical health. Well, we also know by the same studies and same observations that physical health does have a direct relationship, directly proportional to longevity. The healthier you are, the longer you're going to live. If you're constantly fighting illnesses or infections or some kind of organic weakness, like you have diabetes or heart disease or high blood pressure or liver disease or kidney failure or any number of those things, you're not going to live very long. But if you live healthy and you eat a variety of foods in moderation and don't get overweight and don't smoke and don't drink to excess and don't do any of the things that we now know are bad for us in excess, don't stay out in the sun too long, don't let your skin dry out, those kinds of things, you're going to live longer. Now, there's no way to really compare that. I mean, you can't live your life, James, as James number one, and then go back and live again at James number two and say, that's right, definitely moderation. I definitely lived 5 years longer. There's no way to really compare. But when we look at genetic groups, like these very narrow genetic group that was studied in these aged Jews, that it's a fair statistical assumption that being healthy, you'll live longer. And by healthy, I mean both physiologically, that is to say the biological transducer that in which your animated being walks around on this planet, and also psychologically, which means you don't get angry, you don't get jealous, you don't get mad, or if you do, you express it quickly, it's out and done with, and you don't bottle it up inside and try to stress it out and chase it away with other altering things. You just deal with it or work yourself to the point where you never feel that in the first place. There is an interaction between personality and physiology. And that's Dr. Gary Small, director of the UCLA Center on Aging. Small was not involved in Barzilai's study, as I described to you about 10 minutes ago, but has done research in this area. It makes sense that being more positive causes less stress and seems to get people on the right track to live better. It doesn't mean walk around with your head in the clouds all the time. Oh, yes, life is wonderful, wonderful. Oh, yes, no, go ahead, pick up all the furniture, take it back to the furniture store. I know I wasn't able to make the payments, but hey, no big deal. I'll just sit on this nice, comfortable orange crate here. I don't mean that. I mean being able to look at your life in the sense that you don't seek after the awards and rewards of physical life as validation of your joy. Your joy comes from other things, from learning, from playing music, from dancing, the free stuff, the stuff you don't have to travel to the Orient or to the Med to enjoy. You can do right here, right in your own backyard, right in the beach, right on the mountains, right in the wonderful deserts and even the cities that we have. So much culture, so much life, so much diversity and creation. Several studies have found that genetics account for only about one-third of how long and well we live, said Small, who is also author of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program. Barzilai added that it's still not known precisely how personality influences longevity. And that would be a true scientific statement. As I said, you can't live James 1 and James 2 and say, okay, this time, James, we want you to have a really positive attitude. We want you to be bright and cheerful. And remember, it's not personal. And then compare the two. We can't do that. But it seems reasonable that if you go through life hating and jealous and envious and violent your entire life, you're not going to live long. You won't want to. Nobody around you will want you to. We still need to find out what the cause and effect relationship is, he said. We don't know if we can change longevity by having a positive attitude or if achieving longevity causes a positive attitude. Well, one thing about it, you know, the more I think about it, suppose there was some, let's say, some pill that you could take, some injection or a series of treatments that you could take, no matter what the cost, or maybe no cost, it doesn't matter, that you could take in order to, say, flip off all the aging genes and you live to be 480 years old. Now that your positive attitude, your cause and effect relationship between your vibrational level and your age, or the health of your age, is removed from the equation, maybe we wouldn't want to live around you. Maybe nobody would want you to be around at 350 years. You've been a sourpuss for over 250 years, Joe. It's time to shape up a little bit. Because there's no cause and effect relationship. Because, there, in other words, there's no return on investment for having a positive attitude. Maybe we wouldn't. And maybe that's why the aging gene is in there. So that we know if we want to live past 20, and believe me, in Cro-Mag days, the average lifespan was 20. 20. And after World War II, the average lifespan was 55, 58. I remember in the early 60s when people retired from military service after 20 years or 30 years. They lived 10 years, they were dead. Now, these were people that went in at age 18, were in 30 years, got out at age 48 with a 30-year pension, okay? That's 75% of your base military pay for the rest of your life. And they were dead by 58. Maybe it's because they had to go back to work, I don't know. But in any case, we didn't have the longevity that we have today. In the 70s, the GI Bill was ended. Now, I had it when I was in, and I used it to go to school. But the GI Bill changed in the late 70s to where you had to put money in and they would match you, just like any employer. And then when you got out, you saved up money for school. So you did without while you were in so that you could have when you got out. And that was kind of a buy-in to your college education. Not the same benefit. The reason that they did that, and the same thing with retirement benefits, is because people were living much longer. They were getting out at 48 and then living another 50 years. 50 years we were paying them pensions. Unions are feeling the same thing. That's what they just went through up in Wisconsin. And we can talk a little bit about that election if you'd like to as well. But the point that I'm trying to make is we are living longer and longer because the quality of life has the potential to be so much better than it was 30 years ago. 50 years ago, 80 years ago, certainly 100 years ago. We can make life so easy on ourselves, we never break a nail. And that is so different, anthropologically speaking, that we are now evolving as a race. Now, these doctors hope to determine whether centenarians' positive outlook persisted throughout their entire lives, or if their personalities changed between, say, the ages of 70 and 100, as some data have suggested. Regardless of the unknowns, they wrote, the study adds to a growing body of knowledge which suggests that centenarians may share particular personality characteristics and suggests that genetically based aspects of personality may play an important role in achieving positive health outcomes and exceptional longevity. And I think that's true. And I think it's a good investment. So I think you should live long and prosper. And I also think that you should look for the good in others and help it to grow a little bit every day. And if you do that, eventually you'll save the planet. And that's just the way I feel here on X Squared Radio. If you have, I'd still love to hear from you, 888-429-5471. What would you do if you lived well to be 480 years old as a 200-year-old person with all that wisdom? Your 401k would be worth enough to let you live in great style for hundreds of years. What would you do with your age and your wisdom? One thing would be interesting to know, would you be fertile all that time? I mean, would females run out of eggs? Would men run out of the ability to, well, the ability to? Yeah, I think all that has to be there too. I mean, what's the point, right? Well, this week, we eulogize the great Ray Bradbury. I don't know, many of you have heard the name, I'm sure, because of the movies Fahrenheit 451 and the series The Martian Chronicles. And I have to say that when I was young, I read, you know, just about everything Ray Bradbury wrote. And I was so fascinated by his command of the English language. You know, a lot of people can speak English. Most people can. But few people actually master the language. Ray Bradbury was not only a master of the language, he was a master of the relationships between man and science. You know, science fiction often looks out into the future. It you know, launches craft to the moon. It goes 20,000 leagues under the sea. It goes to the center of the earth. It makes ventures far beyond where the science of the day would seem to justify. And then someday, as though the dream of that science fiction writer was manifested somewhere in the future, resonated by millions of readers in dozens of years, and it became reality because all of that energy was vibrating with it as though some magic resonance. And in a lot of ways, I agree with that, because some of the things that science fiction writers imagined, and I mean imaged, put on the screen, put into print, put into sound, into music, into movies, was so well thought of, so well imaged, that it created an image in us. And then we put our emotions as we were walking out of the theater or closing the last cover of the book. And we contemplated, we added energy to those images, and then eventually they became reality. That's the way it's done, I think. That is the way creation is done. And over time, perhaps science fiction writers and imagers, excuse me while I take a sip of grapefruit juice. Okay, that was more than a sip, but it's so good. And so good for you. Over time, their images, their thoughts, their perceptions of future events, or even extreme past events, became anthropological statements, sociological statements, psychological statements, statements on the origin of man, the destiny of man, the interaction of man with other races. I know. We're dealing with a lot of brain-eating aliens now, but you know, in the beginning we had E.T., we had wonderful experiences with aliens that made us look up in the sky a little bit more and not be so afraid at the lights that we saw moving. If everything was War of the Worlds, with Orson Welles narrating on the radio, every time we saw a moving light in the sky, we would run for the cellar and grab the shotgun on the way down. It isn't all that way because of the great and wonderful art, the great and wonderful imagery that these writers and these dreamers brought to us. And for that, we should be grateful. And one of the great thinkers, one of the great imaginers was Ray Bradbury. And I, for one, not only eulogize him, but I offer my great respect for him because in some respects, in many respects, the way that I looked at society and the individual's relationship to it was influenced by the writer Ray Bradbury, by his thoughts. And others were as well. Other writers were as well. Similar to that was a great thinker, a genius of a man, a tremendous writer and imager, a chemist. So in my own heart has some synergy with me, and that is Isaac Asimov. And at the top of the hour, I'm going to read a short story by Isaac Asimov called The Feeling of Power. Now, if you are familiar with this story, I not only will be greatly surprised, but you can call me and we'll talk about it. It's 888-429-5471. And I would like to know from you not only what you would do if you lived to be 480 years old with a good life, but also how science fiction writing and movies and art and things like that have influenced your life. How it has changed the way you look at the goals that you set in life, the impact that mortal existence has upon you on this planet. Do any of you feel like you're not from around here? I mean, I don't know if you came here in a craft and landed and they let you go and said, okay, Peter, now you're going to live on this planet now. I don't mean that. I don't even mean a walk-in. I don't even mean that, you know, there was a rather inattentive man-animal. I just watched Battlefield Earth, so I stole that term. A man-animal, and you stepped in as a sentient being and took it over. But perhaps, you know, you were born here to parents, and you grew up, and ever since you can first remember, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you just felt like you didn't belong here. You just felt just a little bit out of step with what was going on here. And although it may have caused you some problems as a youth, in the sense that you didn't, you know, have a lot of friends, or you didn't belong to a gang, or you didn't run for class president, somehow you just didn't synchronize with the plan, the establishment. You were just a little bit off, just a little bit on the sidelines, but able to see things that other people didn't see. Able to feel things and figure things out that other people didn't see and didn't figure out. If you're that type of person, I want you to call in tonight because I'd just love to hear and learn from what you felt as you read science fiction. Did you feel some kinship with the imagery that they wrote? I used to read Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell. They wrote the Ringworld series about, you know, a very plausible fiber that was discovered that had unbelievable tensile strength. And they actually built a ring of it around Earth, like a ring around Saturn. And the fabric was so strong that you could actually build structures on it. And so they actually built a world around our world that revolved around the equator of the planet. And it was called Ringworld. And he also wrote some other, you know, really interesting books. And, of course, the indomitable Frank Herbert. I mean, come on, the Dune series and, you know, the White Plague and all of that. And Hermann Hesse, Magister Ludi, a great student of the wonderful psychologist that has, you know, talked about man and his symbols and everything almost prehistoric to modern day. I'll think of his name in just a moment. I'm kind of rambling here. But that great psychologist was also Hermann Hesse's psychologist and pulled man and his symbols together to where we think of a collective consciousness. So that's where it originally came from, written way, way back in the 60s and 70s and some great, tremendous work. All of those books, all of that writing, all of that thinking and imagining influenced our society by the millions. I mean, millions and millions of people read these books and saw the movies and imagined those ways of life, you know, well beyond what we see in everyday life. I mean, that, and who's to say it's not real? Because it's just a mental thought. It's just an image. It's just a dream. Maybe it's not as real as, you know, being run over on a motorcycle, but I'm, to be honest with you, once I went unconscious, none of that's real to me either, except for the, you know, fact that my leg and my neck are still healing. But once they're healed, do you think I'm going to be able to recall any of this pain? No, I'm not going to be. It's going to be a memory. It'll be a thought, except for a scar here and there. It's going to be good as new. And the same thing with childbirth, and the same thing with any struggle that we go through. I used to tell my kids when they would say, "Oh, Dad, I don't want to take this test. I don't want to, you know, go confess this. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that." And I would say, "You know what I do when I have to face something really tough like this? I put myself out about 5 days in the future. I just imagine what it's like 5 days after this event, and I look back on it, and I go, you know, I really wish I would have said this. I really wish I would have done that. But at the end of the day, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be." Then return yourself to where you are, which is in the past of the event, and then go through it with the knowledge that you just gained by looking back at it from 5 years in the future. Believe me, it works. You should try it. You have to go through something. You got to go through an argument. You got to let somebody go. You got to go apply for a job, or you got to quit a job. You got to sell something or buy something. It's an event you don't want to go through. Put yourself out there 5 days in the future of that event and look back at it. It wasn't that bad. I mean, they didn't kill me. And when you're out there 5 days in the future, try to take that 2020 view. Do that hindsight thing. Look back at it and say, "You know what? If he says this, I'm going to say this. If she does that, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to let them get at me. I'm not going to let them make me mad. In fact, I'm not going to let myself get mad. I'm not going to be envious. I'm not going to be regretful. I'm not going to be jealous. I'm going to do the thing that makes me feel the best." And you know what? It will blow their minds how strong and how peaceful and how loving you are. And they'll comment on it more than likely. They'll say, "Wow, you know, I really thought you were going to lose it. But I don't know, you surprised me." And that's the perfect time to say whatever it is you thought you were going to say that 5 days out in the future. Look back at it and just say it, because everything you do eventually affects the universe. And you want to try to do that positively, I think. I mean, you could do it for ill. You can definitely affect the universe for ill and make it a bad place. You could. I mean, people do it, but I don't recommend it, because it's just not a great life. It's not a treasure for you. I think you want to do good things, do great things. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to this program, and I'm glad you are. So in, about 3 minutes, we're going to take a break, and we'll listen to some Alice Band. I get a lot of mail on that, by the way. The Alice Band is an a cappella female group, four girls that sing various songs, and one of the songs that I play from them is After the Gold Rush. Now, After the Gold Rush was written by Neil Young, and it has this kind of, you know, sitting in a burned-out basement waiting for the silver ships in the sky to come and load up the people and take them away kind of thing, to a better world sort of theme. And it resonates with people. So I get a lot of mail on it. I appreciate it so much. You can always write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. Also, I want you to visit the website, x2radio.com, at the top. On the right-hand side where the affiliates are, you will notice a new banner. It is the shoptohelpothers.com banner. It's got the red heart with people holding hands around it. My good friend Carl started this company. It is a wonderful idea. What he does is he has gone to many of the major companies, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Advance Auto Parts, all kinds of places. And they all give money to charities, all kinds of charities. And normally they choose which charities they go to. So what he did is he formed a company that allows you to choose the charity that you want your money to go to. The money, not your money, but the money that they would normally donate to the charity, you get to choose. Whether it's Boy Scouts of America or Little League or Habitat for Humanity, or there's lots and lots and lots of charities and are adding them all the time. You get to choose. And if you have a suggestion for a charity, you can send it to them once you get into the website at shoptohelpothers.com. Once you send them to charity, they'll just make a couple of phone calls, check it out, make sure that they're legitimate, and it goes on the charity list. And then every time you make a purchase, a proportion of that purchase goes to charity. And so you get to direct the money. It doesn't cost you a penny more to do, nothing more. And I thought it was such a wonderful idea. I told them I put the banner on the website, and so there it is, shoptohelpothers.com. So before you go to Google and look up, rims for your car, or look up a new handbag, or look up, any kind of products for your home or personal use, click on that banner first and then go shop, because the tracking code will go with you, and then you can control where the charitable donations go to. Sounds like an awesome idea, and I think you should help out. Now, three conferences coming up. One is the Awake Conference. It's coming up in August. I'm going to post all the particulars to that on the website along with a newsletter tonight. There is the Pythagoras Conference coming up in October. Don't forget about that. This is one of the most affordable and easy access conferences, world-class conferences in the world, and it's in the Midwest, so you can drive there. You don't have to have a passport. You don't have to buy a plane ticket. It's at a wonderful resort in southern Indiana, and you're going to love it. If you click on that banner, PythagorasConference.com, at xSquaredRadio.com, you'll get $100 off. And the granddaddy of them all, which is the Maya 2012 conference, this is put on by Power Places. And you know the name Power Places. This is, the cream of the creme as far as conferences in the world. They really, really, really do a good job. And this one is at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan. You go with me. We're going to be leaving in the middle of December, back on the 22nd. I promise to have you home by Christmas. But guess what? You get to spend December 21st, 2012, at Chichen Itza. That's right, with me and Maureen St. Germain and Greg Braden and several others, world-class conference, and you are going to have a wonderful time with us. And so click on the orange banner, Maya 2012. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming to you right after this.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. So glad you could join us here tonight. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Wednesday of this week, I will be on the Coast to Coast AM radio program with George Norrie. We'll be talking about my latest book, Alienated Nation. You want to be ready for that, you should go ahead and get your copy early. I've got a stack of them here, and they're going to go quick. You know that. Go to alienatednation.com and pick up the autographed copy of the book. When you do, you get the audio version as a bonus download for free. So you have the entire book in audio, and you have the paperback signed for a mere $14.95. It's a great deal. Now, if you don't want to do that, you want to go ahead and buy it at Amazon. You might get it for a couple dollars cheaper. It won't come autographed, and you won't get the audio version, but it will make the Amazon ratings much better. Now, one thing you can do is, and this would be a big help to me, really, a big help to me. Are you listening? Do I have your attention? No, put that down. Look. Okay, good. I got your attention now. Buy the book from my website at alienatednation.com. Get the autographed copy. Get the audio version. Listen to it. Read it. Absorb it. And then go to Amazon.com and write me a book review. It's a big help, because then when people go there, they want to know who's read it and what they thought about it. And I think you're going to have good thoughts about it. At least I hope you do. Then you can go to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and you can write a book review. Take 5 minutes. It won't cost you a thing, but you'll be doing me a great favor. And I will most appreciate it, because I will get to see your name there. And it'll be a great thing. If you want to be a part of tonight's program, it's 888-429-5471, toll-free anywhere in North America. The non-toll-free numbers, if you're calling from Japan or New Zealand, if you're up this late, are on the website at bbsradio.com or at xsquaredradio.com. By the way, if you want to have access to all the BBS Radio archives, there is a link at xsquaredradio.com. Click on that. It will take you directly in. You get a great discount, and you can listen to all the hosts on BBS Radio for a very, very reasonable fee, and you'll help out the great studio there in Paradise, California, which actually is in Paradise, California. If you want to just listen to the program by phone anytime Channel 2 is up and running, which is, I think, after 5 p.m. We're on Sunday nights, but you can, of course, dial this number anytime, I think. Dial 760-569-7676, and then the passcode 192919 pound, and you can listen to the program by your phone. If you don't want to do that, we've got it even simpler for you, especially if you have a Droid phone. Go to xsquaredradio.com, and on the left-hand side, guess what we have? We have a Droid app written for you. All you have to do is click on the app, accept it on your phone, and anytime you want to listen to the program live on bbsradio.com, you just click that app and you're in, and you're listening to it. Now that, it doesn't get any simpler than that. We've made it as easy as possible for you to be part of the BBS Radio experience, and specifically the X Squared Radio experience. Now, isn't that cool? We just try to do all that stuff to help you out, to help you stay informed. All right. In the first hour, we talked about the great respect that we have for the late Ray Bradbury, who was a great influence on my early life as a young writer. I was published at 13, and largely just because of reading Ray Bradbury. I also had a great amount of respect for Isaac Asimov, and Isaac Asimov wrote a series of short stories, one of which I'm going to read now, which is called The Feeling of Power. This is just sort of like maybe radio book hour. So just sit back and enjoy it. I think you'll like it. I think it will be inspirational to you. It will certainly be mind-opening, as all of Mr. Asimov's works are. The Feeling of Power, Isaac Asimov. Jehan Schumann was used to dealing with the men in authority on long embattled Earth. He was only a civilian, but he originated programming patterns that resulted in self-directing war computers of the highest sort. Generals, consequently, listened to him, heads of congressional committees, too. There was one of each in the special lounge of the new Pentagon. General Wider was space-burned and had a small mouth puckered almost into a cipher. He smoked a Denebian tobacco with the air of one whose patriotism was so notorious he could be allowed such liberties. Schumann, tall, distinguished, and programmer first class, faced them fearlessly. He said, "This gentleman is Myron Aub, the one with the unusual gift that you discovered quite by accident," said Congressman Brandt placidly. "Ah." He inspected the little man with the egg-bald head with amiable curiosity. Little man, in return, twisted the fingers of his hands anxiously. He had never been near such great men before. He was only an aging, low-grade technician who had long ago failed all tests designed to smoke out the gifted ones among mankind and had settled into the rut of unskilled labor. There was just this hobby of his that the great programmer had found out about and was now making such a frightening fuss over. General Wider said, "I find this atmosphere of mystery childish." "You won't in a moment," said Schumann. "This is not something we can leak to the first comer, Aub." There was something imperative about his manner of biting off that one-syllable name. But then he was a great programmer, speaking to a mere technician. "Aub, how much is 9 times 7? Aub hesitated a moment. His pale eyes glimmered with a feeble anxiety. 63, he said. Congressman Brandt lifted his eyebrows. Is that right? Check it for yourself, Congressman. The congressman took out his pocket computer, nudged the milled edges twice, looked at its face as it lay there in the palm of his hand, and put it back. He said, "Is this the gift you brought us here to demonstrate, an illusionist?" "More than that, sir. Aub has memorized a few operations, and with them he computes on paper." "A paper computer," said the general. He looked pained. "No, sir," said Schumann patiently. "Not a paper computer, simply a piece of paper. General, would you be so kind as to suggest a number?" 17, said the general. "And you, Congressman?" 23. "Good. Aub, multiply those numbers, and please show the gentleman your manner of doing it." "Yes, programmer," said Aub, ducking his head. He fished a small pad out of his one shirt pocket and an artist's hairline stylus out of the other. His forehead corrugated as he made painstaking marks on the paper. General Wider interrupted him sharply. Let's see that." Aub passed him the paper, and Wider said, "Well, it looks like the figure 17. Congressman Brandt nodded and said, "So it does. But I suppose anybody can copy figures off a computer. I think I could make a passable 17 myself, even without practice." If you will let Aub continue, gentlemen," said Schumann without heat. Aub continued. his hand trembling a little. Finally, he said in a low voice, "The answer is 391. Congressman Brandt took out his computer a second time and flicked it. "By Godfrey, so it is. How did he guess?" "No guess, Congressman," said Schumann. "He computed that result. He did it on this sheet of paper." "Humbug," said the general impatiently. "A computer is one thing, and marks on a paper are another." "Explain, Alb," said Schumann. "Yes, programmer. Well, gentlemen, I write down 17, and just underneath it I write 23. Next, I say to myself, 7 times 3, the congressman interrupted smoothly, now, Alb, the problem is 17 times 23. "Yes, I know," said the little technician earnestly, "but I start by saying 7 times 3 because that's the way it works. Now, 7 times 3 is 21. "But, and how do you know that?" asked the congressman. I just remember it. It's always 21 on the computer. I've checked it any number of times." "Well, that doesn't mean it always will be, though, does it?" said the congressman. "Well, maybe not," stammered Alb. "I'm not a mathematician, but I always get the right answers, you see." "Go on." 7 times 3 is 21, so I write down 21. Then 1 times 3 is 3, so I write down 3 under the 2 of 21. "Why under the 2?" asked Congressman Brandt at once. "Because," Alb looked helplessly at his superior for support, it's difficult to explain." Schumann said, "If you will accept his work for the moment, we can leave the details for the mathematicians." Brandt subsided. Alb said, 3 plus 2 makes 5, you see, so the 21 becomes a 51. Now you let that go for a while and start fresh. You multiply 7 and 2, that's 14, and 1 and 2, that's 2. Put them down like this, and it adds up to 34. Now, if you put the 34 under the 51 this way and add them, you get 391, and that's the answer. There was an instant's silence, and then General Wider said, "I don't believe it. He goes through this rigmarole and mix up numbers and multiplies and adds them this way and that, but I don't believe it. It's too complicated to be anything but hornswoggling." "Oh, no, sir," said Alb in a sweat. It only seems complicated because you're not used to it. Actually, the rules are quite simple and will work for any numbers." "Any numbers, eh?" said the general. "Come then." He took out his own computer, a severely styled G1 model, and struck it at random. "Make a 5738 on the paper. That's 5738. "Yes, sir," said Alb, taking a new sheet of paper. "Now," more punching of his computer, 7239, 7,239, "yes, sir. Now multiply those two." "It will take some time," quavered Alb. "Take the time," said the general. "Go ahead, Alb," said Schumann crisply. Alb set to work, bending low. He took another sheet of paper and another. The general took out his watch finally and stared at it. "Are you through with your magic-making, technician?" I'm almost done, sir. Here it is. 41,537,382. He showed the scrawled figures of the result. General Wider smiled bitterly. He pushed the multiplication contact on his computer and let the numbers whirl to a halt, and then he stared and said in a surprised squeak, "Great galaxy, the fellow's right." The president of the Terrestrial Federation had grown haggard in office, and, in private, he allowed a look of settled melancholy to appear on his sensitive features. The Denebian War, after its early start of vast movement and great popularity, had trickled down into a sordid matter of maneuver and counter-maneuver, with discontent rising steadily on Earth. Possibly, it was rising on Deneb, too. And now Congressman Brandt, head of the important Committee on Military Appropriations, was cheerfully and smoothly spending his half-hour appointment spouting nonsense. computing without a computer, said the president impatiently. It's a contradiction in terms. Computing, said the congressman, is only a system for handling data. A machine might do it, or the human brain might. Let me give you an example. And using the new skills he had learned, he worked out sums and products until the president, despite himself, grew interested. Does this always work? Every time, Mr. President, it's foolproof. Is it hard to learn? Well, it took me a week to get the real hang of it. I think you would be better. Well, said the president, considering, it's an interesting parlor game, but what's the use of it? What is the use of a newborn baby, Mr. President? At the moment, there is no use. But don't you see that this points the way toward liberation from the machine? Consider, Mr. President, the congressman rose, and his deep voice automatically took on some of the cadences he used in public debate, that the Denebian War is a war of a computer against computer. Their computers forge an impenetrable shield of counter-missiles against our missiles, and ours forge one against theirs. If we advance the efficiency of our computers, so do they theirs. And for 5 years, a precarious and profitless balance has existed. Now, we have in our hands a method for going beyond the computed, leapfrogging it, passing through it. We will combine the mechanics of computation with human thought. We will have the equivalent of intelligent computers, billions of them. I can't predict what the consequences will be in detail, but they will be incalculable. And if Deneb beats us to the punch, they may be unimaginably catastrophic. The president said, troubled, what would you have me do? Put the power of the administration behind the establishment of a secret project on human computation. Call it Project Number, if you like. I can vouch for my committee, but I will need the administration behind me. But how far can human computation go? Well, there's no limit, according to programmer Schumann, who first introduced me to this discovery. I've heard of Schumann, of course. Well, yes, Dr. Schumann tells me that in theory, there is nothing the computer can do that the human mind cannot do. The computer merely takes in a finite amount of time of data and performs a finite amount of operations on them. The human mind can duplicate the process. The president considered that. He said, if Schumann says this, I'm inclined to believe him, in theory. But in practice, how can anyone know how a computer works? Brandt laughed genially. Well, Mr. President, I asked the same question. It seems that at one time computers were designed directly by human beings. Those were simple computers, of course, this being before the time of the rational use of computers to design more advanced computers had been established. Yes, yes, go on. Well, Technician Alb apparently had, as his hobby, the reconstruction of some of these ancient devices. And in doing so, he studied the details of their workings and found he could imitate them. The multiplication I just performed for you is an imitation of the workings of a computer. Amazing. The congressman coughed gently. If I may make another point, Mr. President, the further we can develop this thing, the more we can divert our federal effort from computer production and computer maintenance. You know, as the human brain takes over, more of our energy can be directed into peacetime pursuits, and the impingement of war on the ordinary man will be less. This will be most advantageous for the party in power, of course. Ah, said the president, I see your point. Well, sit down, Congressman, sit down. I want some time to think about this. But meanwhile, show me that multiplication trick again. Let's see if I can't catch the point of it. Programmer Schumann did not try to hurry matters. Lesser was conservative, very conservative, and liked to deal with computers as his father and grandfather had. Still, he controlled the West European computer combine, And if he could be persuaded to join Project Number in full enthusiasm, a great deal would be accomplished. But Lesser was holding back. He said, "I'm not sure I like the idea of relaxing our hold on computers. The human mind is a capricious thing. The computer will give the same answer to the same problem each time. What guarantee have we that the human mind will do the same?" "The human mind, Computer Lesser, only manipulates facts. It doesn't matter whether the human mind or machine does it. They're just tools." "Yes, yes, I've gone over your ingenious demonstration that the mind can duplicate the computer, but it seems to me a little in thin air." "I'll grant the theory, but what reason have we for thinking that theory can be converted into practice?" "I think we have reason, sir. After all, computers have not always existed. The cavemen with their, you know, tree rims, stone axes, steelies, railroads, they had no computers. And possibly they did not compute. Well, you know better than that. Even the building of a railroad or a ziggurat calls for some computing, and that must have been done without computers as we know them. Do you suggest they computed in the fashion you demonstrate?" Well, probably not. After all, this method, we call it graphitics, by the way, from the old European word grapho, meaning to write, is developed from the computers themselves, so it cannot have antedated them. Still, the cavemen must have had some method. Eh? Lost arts. If you're going to talk about lost arts, no, I'm not a lost art enthusiast, though I don't say there may be not be some. After all, man was eating grain before hydroponics, and if the primitives ate grain, they must have grown it in soil. What else could they have done? I don't know. But I'll believe in soil growing when I see someone grow grain in soil. And I'll believe in making fire by rubbing two pieces of flint together when I see that too. Schumann grew placative. Well, let's stick to graphitics. It's just part of the process of etherealization. Transportation by means of bulky contrivances is giving way to mass transference. Communications devices become less massive and more efficient constantly. For that matter, compare your pocket computer with the massive jobs of 1,000 years ago. Why not then the last step of doing away with computers altogether? Come, sir. Project Number is a going concern. Progress is already headlong, but we want your help. If patriotism doesn't move you, consider the intellectual adventure involved. Lesser said skeptically, "What progress? What can you do beyond multiplication? Can you integrate a transcendental function?" "In time, sir, in time. In the last month, I've learned to handle division. I can determine and correctly integral quotients and decimal quotients." "Decimal quotients? To how many places?" Programmer Schumann tried to keep his tone casual. "Any number." Lesser's jaw dropped. "Without a computer? Set me a problem. Divide 27 by 13. Take it to six places." 5 minutes later, Schumann said, 2.076923. Lesser checked it. "Well, now that is amazing. Multiplication didn't impress me too much because it involved integers, after all. And then I thought trick manipulation might do it. But decimals? Oh, and that's not all. There's a new development that is so far top secret and which, strictly speaking, I ought not to mention. Still, we have made a breakthrough on the square root front." "Square roots? It involves some tricky points, and we haven't licked the bugs yet. But Technician Alb, the man who invented the science and who has amazing intuition in connection with it, maintains he has the problem almost solved. And he's only a technician, a man like yourself, a trained and talented mathematician, ought to have no difficulty." "Square roots," muttered Lesser, attracted. "Cube roots, too. Are you with us?" Lesser's hand thrust out suddenly. "Count me in." General Wider stumped his way back and forth at the head of the room, and addressed his listeners after the fashion of a savage teacher facing a group of recalcitrant students. It made no difference to the general that they were in the civilian scientists heading project number. The general was overall head, and so he considered himself at every waking moment. He said, "Now, square roots are fine. I can't do them myself, and I don't understand the methods, but they're fine. Still, the project will not be sidetracked into what some of you call the fundamentals. You can play with graphitics any way you want to after the war is over. But right now, we have a specific and very practical problems to solve." In a far corner, Technician Alb listened with painful attention. He was no longer a technician, of course, having been relieved of his duties and assigned to the project with a fine-sounding title and good pay. But, of course, the social distinction remained, and the highly placed scientific leaders could never bring themselves to admit him to their ranks on a footing of equality. Nor, to do Alb justice, did he himself wish it. He was as comfortable with them as they with him. The general was saying, "Our goal is a simple one, gentlemen. The replacement of the computer. A ship that can navigate space without a computer on board can be constructed in 1/5 the time and at 1/10 the expense of a computer-laden ship. We could build fleets 5 times, 10 times as great as Deneb could if we could but eliminate the computer. And I see something even beyond this. It may be fantastic now, a mere dream. But in the future, I see the manned missile." There was an instant murmur from the audience. The general drove on. "At the present time, our chief bottleneck is the fact that missiles are limited in intelligence. The computer controlling them can only be so large, and for that reason they can meet the changing nature of anti-missile defenses in an unsatisfactory way. Few missiles, if any, accomplish their goal, and missile warfare is coming to a dead end for the enemy, fortunately, as well as for ourselves. On the other hand, a missile with a man or two within, controlling flight by graphitics, could be lighter, more mobile, more intelligent. It would give us a lead that might well mean the margin of victory. Besides which, gentlemen, the exigencies of war compel us to remember one thing. A man is much more dispensable than a computer. Manned missiles could be launched in numbers and under circumstances that no good general would care to undertake as far as computer-directed missiles are concerned." He said much more, but Technician Aub did not wait. Technician Aub, in the privacy of his quarters, labored long over the note he was leaving behind. I read it finally as follows. "When I began the study of what is now called graphitics, it was no more than a hobby. I saw no more in it than an interesting amusement, an exercise of mind. When project number began, I thought that others were wiser than I, that graphitics might be put to practical use as a benefit to mankind, to aid in the production of really practical mass transference devices, perhaps. But now I see it is to be used only for death and destruction. I cannot face the responsibility involved in having invented graphitics." He then deliberately turned the focus of a protein depolarizer on himself and fell instantly and painlessly dead. They stood over the grave of the little technician while tribute was paid to the greatness of his discovery. Programmer Schumann bowed his head along with the rest of them, but remained unmoved. The technician had done his share, and was no longer needed after all. He might have started graphitics, but now that it had started, it would carry on by itself, overwhelmingly, triumphantly, until manned missiles were possible, with who knew what else. 9 times 7, thought Schumann with deep satisfaction, is 63, and I don't need a computer to tell me so. The computer is in my own head. And it was amazing. the feeling of power that it gave him. That was A Feeling of Power by Isaac Asimov. Kind of let you know a little bit of where the mindset of the folks down at Wars R Us might be. I hope you enjoyed that. That was my my tribute to the great Isaac Asimov in memory of one of my early mentors, I would say, Ray Bradbury. So I hope you enjoyed that. It just shows you the mindset, the imagination, the consideration of early great science fiction writers. They took their stab at social problems of the day. We face the same things today, but obviously such simple prose rarely has the effect, and so we become more animated, more energized in our statements, more inflammatory, more provocative. And since we live in a nation under surveillance, it becomes personally hazardous to make such claims. You'll recall the recent Mr. Booker, who on a talk show excoriated the president for lambasting capitalism and Bain Capital. He said that the people are nauseated because of it and it should stop. Well, Mr. Booker's career is over. He was hoping for a cabinet position in the second Obama term, but no more. His political career as a Democrat is done, because when it comes to the current administration, the long knives are always out. And just in case you don't know what the long knives are, it is a point of history that was noted as the Night of the Long Knives. This was a coup of sorts that was conducted by Adolf Hitler. When he assumed the role of chancellor, one of the things, and I don't mean he was crown chancellor, he assumed the role of chancellor, made himself chancellor. Nobody argued with him. One of the things that he needed was a set of secret soldiers, he called them brown shirts, that would follow orders no matter what, no matter what they were asked to do. And where did he get them? Well, he got them from the prisons, the most violent of the violent. He released them and swore them to his service. He elevated them and put them in brown shirt uniforms. And on one single night, they coordinated a mass assassination. He went after all of his political enemies in one night. It was called the Night of the Long Knives. The brown shirts went out and knifed to death all of Adolf Hitler's political opposition. And that is how he launched to power. And nobody stood in his way for 4 years, 5 years. Well, when they make reference to long knives and the current president, that's what they're talking about. Not a literal assassination, but a political assassination. As long as you play ball, as long as you support his agenda, you're rewarded and you're promoted. But the instant you say, wait a minute, this has gone just a little bit too far. You can't do this. You're finished. One of the amazing articles that's out right now is Obama and the Mighty Data Mining Company. You know we live in a one nation under surveillance, and we know people are watching us all the time. But on the sixth floor of a sleek office building in Chicago, more than 150 techies are quietly peeling back the layers of your life. They know what you read and where you shop, what kind of work you do, and who you count as friends. They also know who your mother voted for in the last election. The depth and breadth of the Obama campaign's 2012 digital operation, from data mining to online organizing, reaches so far beyond anything politics has ever seen. Experts maintain that it could impact the outcome of a close presidential election. It makes the president's much-heralded 2008 social media juggernaut, which raised half billion dollars and revolutionized politics look like cavemen with stone tablets. Mitt Romney indeed is ramping up his digital effort after a debilitating primary, and for sure the notion that Democrats have a monopoly on cutting-edge technology no longer holds water. But it's also not at all clear that Romney can come close to achieving the same level of technological sophistication and reach as his opponent. The campaign was mercilessly ridiculed last month when it rolled out a new app misspelling America. For crying out loud, people. It's all about the data this year, and Obama has that. When a race is as close as this one promises to be, any small advantage could absolutely make the difference, says Andrew Rasej, a technology strategist and publisher of Tech President. More and more accurate data means more insight, more money, more message distribution, and more votes, adds Nico Mele, a Harvard professor and social media guru. The fabric of our public and political space is shifting. If the Obama campaign can combine its data efforts with the way people now live their lives online, a new kind of political engagement and political persuasion is possible. Launched 2 weeks ago, Obama's newest innovation is the much-anticipated dashboard, a sophisticated and highly interactive platform that gives supporters a blueprint for organizing and communicating with each other and the campaign. In addition, by harnessing the growing power of Facebook and other online sources, the campaign is building what some see as an unprecedented database to develop highly specific profiles of potential voters. This allows the campaign to tailor messages directly to them, depending on factors such as socioeconomic level, age, sex, and interests. The data also allows the campaign to micro-target a range of dollar solicitations online, depending on the recipient. In 2008, the campaign was the first to maximize online giving, raising hundreds of millions of dollars from small donors. This time, they are constantly experimenting and testing to expand the donor base. Let's take a quick pause and let's see. Rollin from California, you're on.
Try to take care of yourself.
How are you?
Hello.
You're on Third Radio. What's on your mind?
Hi, is this Mark?
Yes.
So what's going on this week?
Well, you mean this week or tonight's program?
So out here in California, we had a primary election.
Yeah, tell me about it. How did it go? What are your thoughts?
Not too well. I don't know. I guess it went all right. You know, it's just the primary. But I think most people didn't even show up at the polls. Due to lack of interest.
Well, why do you think they weren't interested?
Well, because I think people complain, okay, and they basically love to complain, but to actually get up and go out and vote and try to change something, they feel there's no use, at least in Los Angeles, in my opinion, anyway.
So do you think they thought that the election was a foregone conclusion and they couldn't participate?
Well, I just think that the amount of people that showed up for it is a minimal amount compared to the amount of people here.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. But, you know, I did think that a lot of the public collective bargaining platforms lost energy, maybe momentum was going on in Wisconsin. Is that what you found?
Yeah, I think that people have just lost their will to try at this point. You know, they feel it's all destiny and that the economy is so terrible out here that no matter what they vote for or what they do, it isn't going to matter.
Well, the economy has a lot of different, you know, causes. There are a lot of different reasons. But I think what it takes to get the economy moving again is to get government out of the way so that business people can make it start turning again.
Right. I agree. The problem we have out here is a lot of the business people have left the state of California.
Yeah, exactly, because the regulations are such that it just takes too much to start and run and keep a business running. You know, I was going to save this for later, Roland, but I have a good idea. I call it the Control-Alt-Delete plan. You want to hear?
Control-Alt-Delete plan?
Yeah, you know, like on your computer when you hit Control-Alt-Delete and you get into the... You're able to reboot your computer or start over, go back to a point where the computer was operating correctly?
Right, you go back into DOS and it starts all over again.
Right. Well, Control-Alt-Delete plan works like this. Congress rescinds all regulations passed by all agencies after December 31st, 2007. All regulations are gone after December 31st, 2007. Then they require a two-thirds majority of Congress to pass any new regulations. That puts the people back into the republic. What do you think?
That's a great idea.
Now what happens is we go back. The roads were safe. Our air was clean. Our water was clean. Life was good in 2007. This was before the crash. We do a Control-Alt-Delete. We go back and we give business a stable, almost unchanging business environment, and we let the entrepreneurial spirit of America get the economy of the world moving again.
Right. I agree. I think that's a wonderful idea. Now what you got to do is get them to implement it.
Well, I shared it with my congressman yesterday, and I also shared it with one of the national magazines this morning. So I also mentioned it in my new book, so maybe it'll gain some momentum.
Well, you know what? My congressman, Brad Sherman, who is the one that I've been dealing with, I just found out because of a theft of my house and my Social Security cards and everything else of identity that I was told by a woman named Carrie back there in Baltimore at Citibank, told me she had the same thing happen to her, and to contact the Inspector General of the Social Security Administration in Baltimore, Maryland. And when I told Brad Sherman's office, my congressman, that, they said, oh, we're sorry, we didn't know. So maybe I'll also mention to them, maybe they should consider the Control-Alt-Delete situation of going back and rescinding all those different laws, whatever you want to call them. Okay?
Not the laws, those are passed by Congress. The regulations that are passed by the agencies, the ones we have...
The agency regulations passed since 2007 and December 31st, if they were rescinded back to that time frame before the crash, maybe everything could start again.
Right. It's sort of like playing a game of electronic chess. You find the point where the computer is really kicking your butt, and then you hit the undo button about six or seven times and go back and plan another strategy to go around the computer and beat it. That's what I'm talking about. Just go back
Sounds
to that.
Sounds like a great plan to me.
It's easy. It could be done with an executive order.
Not simplistic. That's the whole thing. It's so simple, they probably won't like it.
That's exactly right.
It's too simplistic for them, man. They got to have it miserable and messed up.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, on that note, Brooke, I'm going to let you go. Okay? All I can say is it's so simplistic for these things to repair, and they just want to make it so damn difficult, it's making everyone miserable.
Well, of course, I can do it without any consideration for politics whatsoever. So it's easy
me
for
me. I don't have one bit of consideration on that level. It's like, let's get this thing jump-started and get it moving again.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Roland. We love you. Call back anytime.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Same here. Bye-bye. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts about this giant data mining operation. I mean, we've always known that any president who masters the art of communicating with people on an electronic basis, almost to a personalized basis, almost to your retina scan. You know, I know you like orange juice, so, you know, how about donating $3? That kind of thing. I know you like to jog. I know you like bicycles. I know you like toy poodles. I know that you buy a lot of health food, and that's always important to us. And, you know, if you'll just give $3. So the data allows the campaign to micro-target a range of dollar solicitations online depending upon the recipient. For example, they have found $3 to be a magic number. Asking supporters for that paltry donation to win a chance to attend a fundraiser with the president and George Clooney or Sarah Jessica Parker has generated tens of thousands of responses. People from whom the campaign can collect highly valuable data and then go back to. They are way ahead of Romney micro-targeting, and it is a level of precision we haven't seen before, says Daryl M. West, a leading scholar on technology innovation at the Brookings Institution. The Obama campaign has been working to under the radar during the Republican primary season. Obama already this year has outspent Romney significantly and outspent his own 2008 levels for online advertising, according to several market analysis numbers. Hey, they could advertise on X Squared Radio. I'd let them, for sure. And then I'd sell advertising space to Romney, too. I'm not saying where they would be placed on the page, maybe one over the other. But I know my listeners are not going to be so moved by propaganda. The hope, but at least I'd have the advertising money, right? I would never do that. I promise I would never do that. Just go to the website and you'll see. I have very, very few advertisers specifically for that reason. The hope for the Obama team, says West, is that his online reach will outweigh any super PAC funding advantage Romney might have for television advertising by reaching deep into communities with targeted online advertising, grassroots organizing, and fundraising. The other hope, of course, is that Obama can replicate some of the online excitement that propelled him into office 4 years ago. That's going to be a little bit difficult to do because, well, now we know him. So while the campaign is beginning to increase staff in preparation for the general election, Romney digital director Zach Moffitt says they will do things differently than the Obama operation. For one, Moffitt says the Romney campaign will outsource much of their data management instead of handling it in-house, creating customized solutions to fit their needs. I also doubt that they'll be nearly as intrusive or as examining. Data mining is, in a lot of senses, a violation of our privacy, and we kind of resent it. But get this. Today, Obama has, I know you're not going to believe these numbers. Are you sitting down? Today, Obama has 16 million Twitter followers. Let that sink in just for a minute. 16 million Twitter followers to Romney's 500,000. And Michelle Obama has nearly 1 million to Ann Romney's 45,000. On Facebook, Obama has nearly 27 million followers to Romney's 1.8 million. It's hard to know how many of either man's followers are non-American. We are building content to a variety of different channels because what has really changed is the channels are different. And so some people are going to get all of their stuff through Facebook. Some people now do Twitter. Some people are going to go directly to our website. Some people like it on email. And some like it on text, Messina said. Less certain for Obama is whether his vast digital empire can recreate the movement and excitement of 2008. Messina makes it clear that some tried and true methods still apply. It's even more important this time than last time to run a real grassroots campaign that's built on turning out our voters, persuading undecided voters, and making sure they'll vote on election day. And that is the kind of organizing we're doing. The question is, are you making donations to the presidential campaign, whether you know it or not, whether you want to or not? If money is the root of all elections, then perhaps we have a real problem on our hands. It could get serious. It could get very, very serious here. The reason I bring this up is not so much politics. It's the data mining. It's the using of science and technology to manipulate the masses. One of the things that I found most interesting as I casually observed the elections of last week, the Wisconsin election was an absolute blowout. It's going to have its effect in other states as well if they capitalize on it. But one of the things that I noticed is you had two different forces working. You had millions upon millions, tens of millions of dollars come in from outside the state, spent on behalf of the recall vote. This was large unions in Philadelphia, New York, and Miami. And these unions came in with all this money and all these outside people. And no, they didn't give money directly to the mayor's campaign. But they did run ads, and they did buy radio spots, and they did walk the streets, and they did have meetings, all kinds of union hall meetings, all kinds of labor speakers and motivators went in and worked that recall. You think that state house filled up with all those thousands of people spontaneously? Absolutely not. That was organized. That was paid for. All those signs, all those T-shirts, all those hats. Millions and millions and millions of dollars was spent to get that recall election going. And you know what? They knew they were going to win because nobody ever in the history of the United States has survived a recall election. No one. Every single politician that has been elected and then recalled has been thrown out of office. They knew they were going to win. Except for one thing. They were wrong. A year and a half later, the people of Wisconsin said three things very, very powerfully. Number one, we don't like the recall process as a method of resetting a political election. It doesn't work for us. If he didn't do anything illegal and he didn't do anything any different than what he campaigned on doing, he should not be recalled. He won fair and square, and let him run his office the way he wants to. The second thing is that the people realized that public unions don't really have a place in society anymore. There is no reason for public employees to collectively bargain. They don't have to do that. They should be given the choice, and they were. And what happened was over 50% of them chose not to be part of the union. It didn't do anything for them. Nothing was there. It was simply an ATM machine for the unions. And the third thing was, that's the only reason the union leadership came in, was for the money. They didn't care about the wages or the employment level of those people. They didn't care about the debt or the deficit of the state. They didn't even care who was governor. What they cared about was the money they were going to lose, because people were going to be allowed to choose for themselves whether to be in the union or not be in the union. And that's what the voters figured out. And once they figured that out, no amount of attack ads would work. And it didn't. It wasn't even close. And I think that's what's going to happen in this presidential election. The people are going to figure it out. It's so easy to sit back and say that the American people are stupid, that they can be convinced by a movie star asking them to donate $3 to get a chance to have tea and crumpets with them. Are you kidding me? Are you joking me? Do you think they give two hoots about what you think? No. I know you don't. I know you don't. I know you will not be moved by these propaganda campaigns. And although you might donate your money, you're not going to give your vote because you figured it out. You know what it means to not be represented in the Republic. You know what this means. You know that it's important that you are represented in your own government. You know that it's important that the goals and the belief that we have in the entrepreneurial free spirit of America is the most important thing. Once we give that up, Once that's taken away, nobody has the right to say anything. And that is when we stop being America. Quick point of news as we finish up the second hour. NASA is launching a new black hole telescope. Oh, this thing is really cool. I mean, it's like right out of 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's got about a 36-foot arm on it, a 36-foot telescoping centerpiece that once it stretches out, it really looks like one of the early spaceships that we saw in science fiction movies. They're going to offer a sneak peek of it on June 11th during a press conference. The telescope is called New Star, NU Star Observatory. It's due to lift off next Wednesday, June 13th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time from the Kwajalein Atoll in the Central Pacific Ocean. Now, they are going to launch some pieces of it as a drop rocket from a jet flying up around 50,000 feet. It drops, and about 8 seconds later, it fires its rockets and launches this piece up into low orbit. The space telescope will use X-ray eyes to study how black holes form and how they grow within galaxies, affecting their evolution. Now, you know, we have the LIGOs, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories, one in Hanford, Washington, one in Livingston, Louisiana. I have visited both of them and spoken personally to the managers of both facilities. Quite fascinating. If you get a chance, if you're anywhere within 100 miles, 200 miles of these things, make the trip. Go down there. If you go down there on a Saturday, make sure you go down early in the morning, 8 o'clock or so, because the tours are over by 2. So don't go Saturday afternoon expecting to get a look around unless you're somebody like me. Then you get a personal tour. But these things are fabulous. They're so large. They just go beyond your imagination. They go beyond the curvature of the Earth. These tunnels go out so far. They're just amazing. They were designed to try to directly measure black holes. The programming and the budget, it takes about $100 million a year to operate these telescopes, has become so huge that the project has kind of languished, but still amazing technological accomplishments. New Star is greatly anticipated by the team because it will give them a chance to look for the X-rays that are emitted right at the edge of the black hole. Now, obviously, if you get too close to it, nothing comes out of it. That's why the gravitational wave observatories were built in the first place, to kind of sense the rippling of space-time by these massive gravitational bodies rotating at their maximum speed out there in space. So what we want to do is we want to get this data back because, honestly, we're not really sure how close a black hole might be to our solar system. We just don't know. You know, because they don't show up. Really small ones would be very devastating. Massive ones, of course, we can see because the starlight, we think, is blocked out. In reality, if Einstein was correct, and we believe he is, the starlight bends around the black hole because it actually warps space-time to the point where light can pass around it. So we can actually see the star on the other side of the black hole because its light curves around the black hole, which means, guess what? There isn't a black hole in perspective in space. There's no point in which there are no stars. They'd be kind of easy to see, sort of like a black moth sitting on the side of a beech tree. It just would stand out like a black sore thumb. It doesn't happen because light bends around these highly gravitational bodies. So we need to be able to see them, and the way to do it is not by looking for visible light, but by looking for X-rays. And that's why we're anxious to get this up there and just see how close these black holes might be. Let's take a quick break, 5 or 6 minutes, and we'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. Third hour coming up. Here I go.
seven lighters many times, so many times, for no reason to talk about.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're so glad you're here with us tonight. Third hour of X Squared Radio, June 10th, 2012. This week was the Venus Transit. We're going to try and get James Gilliland to come on the program here for a couple minutes and give us his perspective on it. Lots going on. Our phone lines are all open, 888-429-5471, toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. So glad that you're here with us, Sito. We would not be here if it wasn't for you. You remember last week I was blown away, at least I relayed my astonishment, utter astonishment, when it was revealed that the Stuxnet virus was co-developed and deployed by the United States. I didn't know that. Honestly, we had done an investigation early last year. I think it was in April of last year, right after the Fukushima quake and the subsequent reactor failures, that we had discovered that the Stuxnet virus was present in those reactors. And that might have been responsible for the meltdown, not necessarily the damage to the area, but the meltdowns. And how, we knew at least at that time that Israel was responsible for developing the Stuxnet virus, and that an Israeli firm from Dimona, Israel, had visited the firm just a few weeks before, visited the plant just a few weeks before and installed surveillance cameras, and there was an opportunity to infect the computers at Fukushima with the Stuxnet virus. We tied all that together here, and we made an absolutely stunning revelation through our good friend that did the investigation, and we gave him all the credit at the time. Now, last week it was revealed that by the administration that the U.S. was involved in the development and deployment of the Stuxnet virus, and even Norton Antivirus was bragging that they had reverse engineered the virus to develop an even more nasty version. Well, I was so shocked by this leak that I wondered about the motivation for it. I thought, what is the point here? And I think the president was trying to look like he was really on top of things and really the great, national defense president. He was trying to make sure we knew he was leading the cyber warfare team and really making life hard on the Iranians, blah, blah, blah. Well, the game got really stinky very quickly when we reminded everyone that the Stuxnet virus had infected the Fukushima reactors and was very likely the cause for the meltdown. In retaliation for Japan agreeing to enrich uranium for Iran. It just didn't make sense. This whole leak didn't make sense. Well, fortunately, the folks down at Breitbart never sleep. They checked out the president's story, that we knew about it, and helped develop it. Well, they found out he was lying again. Israeli officials who were placed at risk by the Obama administration's leaks about the Stuxnet virus are disputing American claims that the cyber warfare weapon was jointly developed by the U.S. and Israel. Rather, they say, Israeli intelligence first started developing cyberspace warfare against Iran, only convincing the U.S. with some difficulty to join in. The Israelis allege that President Barack Obama claimed credit for Stuxnet to boost his re-election campaign. I'm not making this up, folks. The source for the new claim is Yossi Melman, a journalist for Israeli's left-wing Haaretz Daily. The Israeli officials actually told me a different version. They said it was Israeli intelligence that began a few years earlier a cyberspace campaign to damage and slow down Iran's nuclear intentions. And only later they managed to convince the USA to consider a joint operation, which at the time was unheard of. Even friendly nations are hesitant to share their technological and intelligence resources against a common enemy. Yet, my Israeli sources understand the sensitivity and the timing of the issue and are not going to be dragged into a battle over taking credit. Quote, "We know that it is the presidential election season," one Israeli added, "and don't want to spoil the party for President Obama and his officials who shared in a twisted and manipulated way some of the behind-the-scenes secrets of the success of cyber war." The Obama administration's pattern of leaks to mainstream media outlets, of which the Stuxnet virus is only one example, prompted bipartisan outrage from Congress and the appointment of two special prosecutors. While the leaks jeopardized U.S. national security, allegedly for the political purpose of burnishing President Obama's image as a commander-in-chief, they may also have been exaggerated if the new reports from Israel are accurate, and I believe they are. And don't believe what you hear about bipartisan outrage. They act outraged, but let's not forget that it was, in fact, Dianne Feinstein who leaked the shocker about the U.S. using drones to take out bad guys. That was an extreme top secret, and she spilled it so casually a couple of years back that we all questioned her competence. She is 79 years old, you know. By the way, both U.S. special prosecutors appointed by Holder to investigate are large Obama campaign contributors. Is that reason enough for recusal? Well, in my book, it is. Don't look for anyone anywhere close to the White House to be implicated. Blah, blah, blah. Now, also recently, the Bilderberg meeting happened. A lot of you wrote me about it. A couple of you called me. And I appreciate the emails, and I really appreciate the phone calls. You all know that the Bilderbergs met in Chantilly, Virginia. Alex Jones was out there, and a couple thousand people, not all at once, but I think at once maybe there were 1,000 people on the street in front of the hotel there in Chantilly, the Marriott in Virginia. And I think the public was aware of what was going on, and some of the rhetoric was a little provocative and a little inflammatory. We don't really get involved in that. But everyone knows that the Bilderbergs is a group of the world's elite, the world's powerful. I'm not saying the wealthy, because some members of the press, some politicians, you know, you remember in 2008 that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were invited. And the week after the meeting of the Bilderbergs, Hillary Clinton withdrew suddenly, mysteriously from the election, and Barack Obama went on to be president against the milquetoast John McCain. Now, I remember John McCain very clearly because in the 1996 election, I wrote a speech for Alan Keyes. Alan Keyes had a scheduling conflict and could not be in Chattanooga, Tennessee for the Lincoln birthday fundraiser for the Republican Party. And so Keyes' campaign called up and said, ask me to give the speech. So when I went down there to give the speech, there were four of us there. There was Zach Womp. There was John McCain. There was Bob Barr. And there was me. And I was representing Alan Keyes. So before the speaking event, we were given exactly 10 minutes, no more. We could take less, but we couldn't take any more. And we chose who was going to be in speaking in which order. And I spoke last. I think John McCain spoke second. Bob Barr spoke first. Zach Womp spoke right before me. Zach Womp is a local politician in Tennessee, and I think he is still active in state politics there. So the speeches went as predicted. Bob Barr was pretty boring. John McCain was as dry as milk toast. Finished in about 7 minutes, and you could hear, you know, spoons clanking and, you know, dessert bowls and glasses, ice and glasses and stuff out in the audience. It was basically crickets. As Zach Womp got up and gave a rousing, unscripted, good old Southern Baptist rousing speech, just jacked everybody up, got a great applause out of everybody. He's such an energizing personality. And then I got up and I gave the speech that I wrote for Alan Keyes, which got two standing ovations, not including the one at the end of the speech. It was a tremendously good speech. So I got a chance to be exposed to the real world politicians, and I've met Dick Armey, and I've met Senator Graham, and, you know, others, and they're in real life not what you see on TV. They're somewhat much more reserved than that. I think the only one that really lives up to is reputation is McHenry from North Carolina. He is as awesome in person as he is on television and a C-SPAN when he gives speeches. He's really an energizing personality. And I think also Larry Kissel out of North Carolina is much better in person than he is, you know, on the microphone. He's just such an engaging personality, so genuine, so common sense. A Democrat, but I promise you he's a Reagan Democrat. Really, really good guy, strong guy. So in any case, what we see is, you know, there's something we can take away from these Bilderberg meetings that's pretty positive. Everyone knows they get together somewhere, you know, for the past, what, 59 years, and they make what they think are high-level decisions to protect and to maximize their investments and perhaps even make some ideological changes to the world. But let's all get real here, okay? Does anyone think for a moment that the Wisconsin recall election went anywhere close to the way the elitists wanted? Show of hands? Exactly right. No, it did not. Do you know what that tells me? They don't have control over this world. The Bilderbergs can meet. They can have their little votes and their little rituals and their secret whatever, naked handshakes or whatever it is they do. They can have all that. But they don't control us. They think they know which way we'll go. They try to, you know, build a maze that we will walk down and make them wealthy and allow them to control the world. But we are awake and aware as a people. And we're not going to stand back for these secret room, you know, secret dark room deals anymore. They cannot control a conscious people. They know it, and you know it. So there is hope for the planet. What we outlined in 2004 when we launched the first volume of The Ark of Millions of Years, when the last volume came out in 2007, and 2008, and it took the world by storm, literally just launched. In fact, the first volume became an Amazon bestseller for a second time when the third volume came out. That's how large the audience became. It was huge. And what happened was the effect that we tried to have with the writing of those books and then later with Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel was to awaken people so that we would arrive at a different 2015 than what we saw in 2004. We actually took a mental time travel to the year 2015, and folks, we didn't make it. I mean, we made it to 2015, but the human race didn't make it. The United States collapsed. The world economy collapsed. Everything fell apart. It all broke into tribes. Everything was in chaos. But now we see the possibility for a different 2015. We now have enough awake people out there, enough aware and awake people out there, because of the books we wrote, because of the way we tried to awaken people, not to our ideas, but to their ability to craft any future they want, that the Bilderbergs and other groups like them lost us. They became unaware of us. Now, I said with Rollin when he called from California in the last hour that I propose that we rescind all regulations passed by all agencies, departments, bureaus, administrations like the EPA, the DEA, the you know, all of them, the NHTSA, the GSA, all of them, every agency, rescind, that is to say, strike down, erase, negate, control, alt, delete, reset, scrap, shred, all regulations passed by all agencies after December 31st, 2007. Then pass what I call the Agency Regulation Act. Call it the Control-Alt-Delete Act, that requires a two-thirds approval by Congress for all regulations from all agencies. This is critical. It is vital because it puts you and me back into the republic. It takes the law writing ability away from the agencies. Okay? Once you do that, because now they can write regulations, and they write them, 600 a month. Who can keep up with that? No business can keep up with that. You know, Commerce Bank started just a few years ago. Now it has, I don't know, several hundred branches around the country. It's one of the fastest growing banks. No fees. They pay you interest on your checking. They're open 7 days a week. I mean, it's a huge idea, hugely successful. Do you know what the founder of that bank did last week? He opened another bank in Europe because the regulations are so bad in this country right now. You can't open a bank. You can't do it. He could not open his business and start it over at the same level in this country at this time. The regulations are so bad. The reason is we are not involved in the writing of those laws. Those regulations which tax us, which enforce us, which regulate and curtail our business activities, the way we move money, the way we make money, the way we save money, the way we approach the community, franchise laws, all of these regulations that at one time we could do business. Small business could make it in this country. The American dream was alive and well in this country. Well, it's dead. It's dead and stomped out like an old cigarette butt, and it's about to get swept up and gone forever because we have been removed from the republic. Well, this act puts you and me back into the republic. Then, if we the people don't like the regulations that are passed, we can fire our congressmen, okay? They now become accountable. They are accountable to us. We do it every 2 years. We fire them on a regular basis. Unless, you know, they happen to run in a district where the people will elect them no matter what they do. I mean, come on. There is Maxine Waters and Sheila Jackson Lee, and, you know, there's other individuals out there that, come on. I mean, they're functionally illiterate. And yet they keep getting elected over and over and over again. Why? I have no idea. I guess because they keep bringing the checks home. But, you know, we have to get back into this republic. We've got to hold our congressmen and our senators accountable. I don't think Harry Reid is going to get reelected if he's up for election this time. I'm not sure if he is this cycle or not. You know, they're elected every 6 years. But, you know, we've gone now 1,000 days in the Senate with no budget. 1,000 days. In the Senate with no budget, even though it's the law. They're in violation of federal law, and they don't care. They have no intention of writing a budget. You know what that means? That means that you can go down to the mall and just keep writing checks, baby. Just keep scanning that debit card and putting in your code. Fill up the car, go home, come back, and do it again the next day. Because you don't have a budget, and you don't care. Because somebody else is paying off your debit card. And when it gets close, the bank says, dude, you're out of money. It's simple. You just force the bank to print more money and put it in your account. The presidential czars and ministers follow his direction and his alone. That is not how it is supposed to work. We have no representation nor recourse with these agencies. They must be stopped. So I suggest you order and read the book, Alienated Nation, and take your awareness and action levels to the next power of 10. Let's get this moving a little bit, okay? Take control of what's going on. Don't let these data mining operations and data manipulation make your decisions for you. You can do it. So, one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight, and we're trying to get James Gilliland to come on the phone and help us out. I had written him earlier in the week and asked him if he would come on, and he didn't write back, but he is getting ready for his annual conference up there at the ranch. I'm not going to be there this year. Cannot be. Have a lot of scheduling conflicts with the car company, so I just can't be up there this year. My maximum apologies for that, but I will definitely make plans to get up there later in the year. I wanted him to come on because I want to discuss this Venus transit that happened last week on the 5th. It was photographed like it has never been photographed before. I mean, some of the images that are going to come out of magazines and stuff here and in the near future are just going to blow you away. It's just amazing to see another planet in our solar system cross across the face of the sun. We were able to photograph this by spacecraft, by several places on the Earth through telescopes, and it was amazing. It was phenomenal. So gorgeous. Now, several people out there have had comments about what the Venus transit means, what's going to happen. Every 105, 106 some odd years or so, Venus crosses in front of the sun relative to Earth twice, 8 years apart. It crossed across in 2004. It crossed across in 2012. Now, in 2004, we also had the grand sextile alignment where six planets, including the large asteroid Chiron, arranged themselves in a Star of David pattern around the Earth, and there was a full lunar eclipse. This was such a rare event that the last time it occurred, it heralded the birth of King Solomon. And it was said at the time of the birth of King Solomon that the next time that astrological alignment would take place, the keys to understanding the creation of the Earth would be restored. That's why we put it on the cover of the first volume of The Ark of Millions of Years, and that's why people resonated so well with that book, because that book did restore all of those understandings. So the transit of Venus across the sun has been associated with many cataclysms throughout history. Now, it's an easy thing to do because, you know, we have cataclysms on a fairly regular basis. Volcanoes, earthquakes, tsunamis, you know, meteor showers, large cosmic blasts from the sun, you know, all kinds of things that happen on an unpredictable but fairly regular basis. And it's easy to go back in time through history and say, oh, well, gee, in 2004 we had this happen. And in 1904 we had this happen. And in 1809 we had this happen. It's easy to go back and align the Venus transit with all kinds of cataclysmic things. So what I would like to know from you out there, 888-429-5471, is what have you noticed in your life, your community, your observation of what's going on planet Earth relative to the Venus transit? What happened to you? What kind of enlightenment did you have? Did you have an epiphany? Did you have a life change? Did you have a healing? Did you have some event that happened in your community, your life, your family, that you can attribute to the timing of the Venus transit? Anywhere in North America, toll free 888-429-5471. Astrologers have their place. I participated in an exercise once when I was a senior in high school. And I think it was a math teacher that did this. Excuse me just a moment while I take a sip of my wonderful grapefruit juice. I think there were 28 of us in his math class, and he had 28 manila envelopes with our names on them. And what he had done is he had gone to the roll, and he had taken our birth date, and he had looked up our astrological sign. So he said. And what he put in the envelope was our horoscope, okay? Not our daily horoscope, but a description of the individual sign, like a Gemini, like a Cancer, like a Taurus. And what he did is he put the description into the manila envelope, and he went down each row and he handed out the manila envelopes by name and told us not to open them until he told us to. When we all got the envelopes, he gave us instructions that we were to read this silently and then put the paper back in the envelope, and then he would call on us to answer questions. So we did that, and it was a paragraph or so. It wasn't like, you know, several pages. And I got to tell you, I mean, when I read this thing, it just nailed me. It just nailed me. So, I mean, as far as a description of myself, of my personality traits. So I put mine back in the envelope, and sure enough, the last person finished reading, you heard the rustle of the paper go back in the envelope. And the math teacher said, so, how can I see by a show of hands how many people thought the horoscope described them very on a scale of 1 to 10, let's say 8 to 10? Well, I mean, half the class raised their hand. And how many people say between 5 and 8? And the rest of the class raised their hand. I mean, it just was phenomenal how close these things were. And he said, you know, astrology is a mathematical way of looking at the universe, all of the heavenly bodies that we can see. And astrologers map the movements of these heavenly bodies, and their idea is, the theory is, that they influence biological life on this planet, namely the human beings that are born here, and that your birth sign aligns with the way these planets influence the water and the molecules that make up your particular body, and so therefore make up your personality traits. And depending on whether you were born, you know, what hour you were born, what day you were born, what you were born, you can have a chart made of all your, you know, your personality traits and whether the moon is rising this or Mars is rising or Venus is rising. And all of these different things have an influence upon opportunities, optimum opportunities for you to make your decisions. And he said something interesting in the class. He said, you know, millionaires do not make decisions based on astrology. But billionaires do. And I thought that was phenomenal. That was something that really amazed me. That millionaires did not make decisions based upon the astrology, but billionaires did. So if that's the case, hang on 1 second here while I finish this. If that's the case, if billionaires really do make decisions based upon astrology, that they take into consideration the alignment of the stars, the alignment of the planets, and how it's going to influence individual lives, then maybe there's something to it. And so he said, now that you know this, now that you have your general life description, how the astrology describes you, I want you to take the envelope and I want you to hand it to the person behind you. And so we did that. We took it and handed it to the person behind, and the person in the back brought theirs to the front. And he said, now, I want you to open the envelope again and read it. And it was the same. It was the same paragraph, the same text for everyone in the room. Now, that was pretty phenomenal. I mean, that just pretty much blew me out of the water. That is to say, I looked at that and I said to myself, all this whole description of astrology, this whole thing about, you know, the science of astrology and where it all came from and that, you know, billionaires do and millionaires don't, all that. And yet he just shot it all out of the water by saying it was all bogus, because here we were, you know, taking the whole system apart by handing it back out to people. And saying, I'm sorry, by the way, it's all bogus, because everybody got exactly the same thing. What do you do with that? I mean, how do you react to that? So I guess my question is to you, do you put any stock in astrology? And if you do, I want you to consider maybe one of my observations about this. Because, I have an observation as well, and that is this. It takes about 9 months, 36 weeks, 37 weeks for a human egg and sperm to mature to a full-term fetus to be delivered, right? Now, you know, during that time, you're still in water, you're still developing, you're still, you know, the animated, wonderful being from wherever you came from. You're in and out of that fetus consciously throughout its development. And finally, when you come into this world and break the umbilical cord with your mother, you're in the body. That's it. You're this amazing, advanced being with all these wonderful memories from dozens, perhaps thousands, perhaps millions of lives, and you can't say a word. You can't even control your hands, your feet, or your bowels. And it takes you about 8 or 9 years before you figure out, you know, that you're even conscious. And probably longer than that, some people never do it, but even longer than that before you master the art of being a human being. Or the science of being a human being. My question is the astrology really tied to your birth date? And here's my point. I was born about a month and a half premature. I was born at about 7.5 months because my mother, you know, tripped and fell and induced labor rather traumatically. And so I came into this world early. Now, I'm a Gemini, being born on May 27th, but really, I was supposed to be born like July 5th, so that would change me completely, wouldn't it? That would mean I was a completely different birth sign, but in reality, I'm exactly the same age because I was conceived on a fixed date. So do you think that the astrological date has more to do with the time of conception than it does with the time of birth? It's just a thought. I don't know if anybody's written that. I just had that thought. And I wondered if you had any support for that or not. 888-429-5471. If you're an expert in astrology, help me out a little bit here. Because I think that the union of the animated being that makes you that thing that you're surprised by every time you look in the mirror is not you. The you is inside, the animated being, the thing that makes the tone of your voice, that makes the look in your eye, that makes the purpose of your touch and the intention of your voice and your thought. That thing, that's the real you. That is timeless. And that has probably nothing to do with the stars and planets in perspective with Earth, unless, of course, you've reincarnated here over and over and over again. I, for one, am thoroughly convinced I'm a first-timer here. I came from somewhere else, and I think many of you did too. In which case, that would mean that my perspective of the stars in my last lifetime was quite a bit different than my perspective of the stars now, which means my astrological charts would be way different than they are now. In fact, the planets that I remember are much closer than the planets we see now. The planets we see now look like fast-moving stars that go across the sky. But when you can look up and see the color of a planet, you know, like looking at Earth from the moon, then you really have a different perspective, let me tell you. And I'm sure you have a different astrology. Well, the same thing applies here, folks. Earth Explorers, I'm just trying to tell you that I think astrology is tied more to your date of conception than it is the date you spewed the last bit of amniotic fluid out of your nose. I think it means more. I think if you take the date of conception, which for me would be, I don't know, I have to count backwards from 7.5 from almost 6, that would put me somewhere in the early December area. That's quite a bit different than the July area or the May area, which is where I was actually born, the July area where I should have been born. You know, it's the only reliable point of connection where the biological transducer and the spirit are tied together. Boom, you're linked. That's it. That's your assignment. I think you, in some respect, choose your parents, and possibly your parents were involved in that decision long before we came here. And that's just one of my thoughts. I'd like to share more of them, but I would like you to ask the questions. 888-429-5471. What do you think? If you're too bashful to call, and I understand if you are, then you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com if you're listening to this as an archive. Do that. Think about that for a moment. I mean, astrology, if you look up your daily horoscope, I think you're going to be surprised, because you can probably grab a newspaper from just about any other day and read it, and you're going to find something pretty darn close, I think, unless you read those things every day and you say, somebody out there is making a decision about, hey, you're going to meet somebody great, or today's a good day to start a business, or by all means, don't write any big checks today, you know, that kind of guidance. But I have some good friends. You know, I got Maureen St. Germain, and she's very attuned to which planets are moving and which stars are aligned, and she's a big believer in that, and she manages things according to that, and who knows, maybe she's a billionaire. Billionaires do make their decisions based on astrology, and millionaires don't. Maybe that's why we're $129,000 millionaires were lost in the last 3 years in the United States, because millionaires don't use astrology to invest and plan with their wealth. And that's just my thoughts on it. I don't know. I'm kind of lost when it comes to astrology. I'm not a student of it, but I would like to say I'm an enthusiast. I'm fascinated that something so ill-supported by empirical fact could survive so long. And if you think that it is supported by empirical fact, that there is something out there that supports it or tells people that, you know, astrology does have some merit, some reason for us to keep it around, or even keep the word in our lexicon without raising our eyebrows and rolling our eyes, give me a call, 888-429-5471. Now, we've got about 15 minutes left as we approach this week. It is full-on summertime now. Summertime will be at the longest day of the year in 11 days. So the next program we have on the 17th will be 1 week before we have Amit Goswami on the program. He is the quantum activist. We're going to be talking about his newest book here on X Squared Radio. I want you to take stock, because we're about halfway through the year. Take stock of what you have accomplished so far this year. If you think that you have done your best, then you have no regrets, my friends. Whether you're still unemployed, or whether you're newly unemployed, or whether you're just now working a job and you're working for far less than you're used to making, if you've done your best, you have no regrets. There is no shame in this whatsoever. But if you feel in the least like you did not do your best, you didn't get up as early as you thought you could get up, or work as late as you thought you could work, you didn't try your hardest, you didn't follow your dream, then you have some work to do. Because if you let this mortal life pass you by and realize this, my friends, this may be heaven. When you think about it, compare what we do here, what we experience here in this mortal life, as out of control as you feel you are with society, and maybe even with your own life condition at this moment, and we can discuss that another time. But as out of control as you feel you are with that, I want you to compare that with the idea that you have died, you're sitting on a cloud, you know everything, there is no challenge, there is no mystery, and you have a harp laying in your lap. Is that really heaven to you? And if you were a god, timeless, ageless, knowing all, knowing everything without challenge, without mystery, would you wish for yourself a world where you could struggle? A world where you had to work to gain perfection? Where you had to learn and memorize and use and assimilate that knowledge to stand and reach further and further? A world where you could actually imagine? A world where you could love and be loved? Where you could succeed and fail? where you could feel such amazing joy and see such incredible beauty and experience pain and disappointment and failure. I think the latter. I think if we were the enterprising young gods that we remember we were, or that we aspire to be, that is exactly the kind of world that we would plan for ourselves, where we could reach our highest potential, where we could challenge ourselves. Look at the kind of being we are. We run races. We jump over bars and over lines. We race cars. We race airplanes, jet skis, skateboards, any kind of challenge that we can do against gravity, against nature, against water, against each other, against ourselves. We drive ourselves to do it, and we do it from the time we can first walk. We lift more weight. We learn more lessons. We reach further. We fly higher. We explore further. That's our nature. That's who we are. If we are that being inside, why would we ever be happy with terminal knowledge? Not requiring any faith, not requiring any belief, not requiring or demanding any chance. That's the heaven that we have before us. Now, the gurus of yoga would say life is all about suffering, and that if you have a pleasure or a joy, don't worry about it. It'll pass. Suffering will return. Life is all about suffering. And the goal is to kill yourself relative to this world. Don't let it influence you. Just reach your state of miserable nirvana. Reach your point where you're so low and you have no aspirations for anything above a grain of sand. And that way, you can't be disappointed. Or you are this leaping, flying, wondering, loving, imaginative, musical being that loves to have wonderful days, that loves to have great relationships with people, that loves to laugh and to smile and to taste great food and to listen to wonderful music and to feel smooth skin, and to kiss lips, and to breathe on one another, and to play with children. That life, that's what I want you to set for yourselves for the next 6 months of this year. If you have not experienced that already this year, reach out and grab it. Because it's there for the taking. It's there for the building. And let me tell you, you can't dream too large. Now, you can dream crazy, and you can dream scattered, or you can dream focused, and you can dream large. And when you dream large, you're in effect leaping beyond. You're jumping further. You're seeing further into space than it has ever been seen before. That's the kind of being we're looking for. That's the kind of force that raises us up, that gives us hope, that makes us love, makes us imagine. And it's not so esoteric. You know, I'm sounding like it is because of the tone of my voice and the fact that my eyes are about half open right now as I imagine these things for you, but I'm also very scientific about it because these energies definitely are inputs to the universe. They are inputs to the average reality of this planet. Of that, there can be no doubt. They are cumulative and multiplicable. That is to say, your consciousness can square itself. Your consciousness can create resonance mathematically to where you could move the mountains that you perceive are in your way. And they will move. Be positive. Be uplifting. take on the challenges, draw out your obstacles onto the game field, and challenge them face to face. You remember when you were a little kid and you used to have nightmares, some monster was chasing you or some terrible clown was chasing you. Somewhere along the line, and if you didn't do this, you should do this the very next opportunity you get. You turn around and you face that thing in your dream and you say, you are going to stop bothering me. You're done. I'm done with you. When you do that, you consciously take control of the challenges in your life and you move to the next level of sentience. Continue to do that, my friends, whether you're struggling with mathematics or you're struggling with a promotion at your place of employment. And have respect for your employers, too, because they're trying to make a profit. They're trying to stay in business. And although you look at your individual place with the company, you must look at your collective place with the company as well. Because you think, well, I've been here a long time and I deserve a raise, or I do more around here than that guy and I deserve more money than he makes. There's that battle that goes on in your mind. I see it. I hear it. I hear it all the time. Believe me. And I've been a manager and I've, you know, heard the people complain that I do more than they do and yet they make the same amount of money as me, or they make more money than me because they've been here longer than me. I've heard all that. I hear you say it. I hear you think it. So I want you to take a look at your place in the company as well and realize that that company is not your path to success. It is not. It is just enough money to pay your bills, make your house payment, or whatever. That's only 8 hours a day, my friends. You have another 8 hours a day. Don't waste it. Don't go home and watch TV. Don't go home and crack a beer. Prop your feet up on the easy chair. Waste your life away till 11 p.m. and go back to sleep saying, well, I got to work tomorrow. Make something. Build something. I don't care if it's a hobby car in your garage or if it's a barbecue pit in your backyard or if you take up painting or poetry or writing a book. You've got another 8 hours a day. You better pick a job. You better pick something that gives you happiness. It can give you money, too. It can give you money, too. You can do that. You can pick up a second job. You can flip hamburgers. You can deliver pizza. You can paint houses or mow grass. You can do that if you want to, if you're all about making the money. But I mean pick up something that makes you happy. You always want to learn the guitar? Don't sit back and say, I always wanted to learn the guitar. Go enroll in a guitar class. You always want to learn to dance? Don't watch it on TV. Go take a dance class. You always wanted to learn how to race go-karts or surf or windsurf or paint or make fancy sandcastles on the beach? Don't sit there. Find a group. Get involved because you only have this much life. You're not going to live to be 480 years, my guess is. You have so much life. Take advantage of the sleeping and dream hard and make sure to make love before and after. And then imagine and seek after those images. Climb the trees, climb the mountains, make the trips, write the books, write the poetry, sing the songs, go sing karaoke. If you can force your heart back down your throat with fear, overcoming your fear, go try it. You'll like it. You'll get good at it if you can carry a tune in a bucket. And even if you can't, people will applaud you for trying it. I think you should try things. This is the year when you're going to do it. This is 2012. This is the awakening of your soul. This is the awakening of your chance to make your shot at your dreams. And you know when you're going to start? Now. As soon as this radio program is over, you're going to look up where to get involved in one of your hobbies or one of your dreams or one of the things you always wanted to do. And I only want you to take on the I always wanted to do list. That's for the other 8 hours a day. You always wanted to be a dad. You always wanted to be a scoutmaster. You always wanted to be a little league coach or a soccer coach. You go do it. And don't let anything, least of all yourself, stand in your way. Remember this, the goal The objective of this mortal life is not to get out of here. Somebody told me one time, you know, we're never going to get out of this alive. Oh, you're wrong. We're all going to get out of this alive. More alive than you can imagine. And maybe, just maybe, you get to take the memories with you this time. Because you're listening to this program, and you're awake, and you're aware, and you know what the game, you know what's going on. You can take a conscious part in that process. We have about 2 minutes left, so don't forget. Go to alienatednation.com, pick up your paperback copy, autographed, of Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. You will not only get the book, but you'll get the audio version for free as an instant download with your receipt. Now, after you read the book, and many of you have already read it, and I'm going to be on Coast to Coast Wednesday of this week, and a whole bunch of them are going to go out there. But a lot of you have read it, a lot of you are listening to this archive. Please do me, your humble host, a favor, and go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and write a review for the book. If you've read the book or if you listen to the audio book, please go there and write a review. I would like you to write a good one, 5 stars hopefully, but write a review. Help me out, because when people go there and research the book and they see your review, it helps them make a decision on whether to buy the book or not. It doesn't cost you anything, but it will help me out if you do that. And I would greatly appreciate it. I will show my appreciation in ways that I can assure you will be worth your while. I don't know what way it'll be. I haven't even thought about it yet. But I promise to send you good energy your way. And I'll even mention you by name if you write a good review on the book. Not a quid quo pro. Even if you just write a review, 2 stars, 3 stars, 5 stars, whatever, I'll talk about it with you. So don't despair, and we'll see you next week right here on the 17th on X Squared Radio. Thank you so much, Earth Explorers.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.